Welcome to the Broken Pie Chart Podcast, episode 270. I'm your host, Eric Moore. With me this week, Jay is off again, actually. Just me. And he'll be back next week. All right, lots to talk about, though. And we got to get into the expectation of Fed funds futures, about Fed rate cuts. Does it really matter? I'm not sure. We'll get into that. We need to talk a little bit about the PCE, the inflation, and we had some earnings. And I'll talk a little bit about options pricing pre-earnings, because we're seeing some interesting stuff, especially on NVIDIA. So I'll get to that in a little bit. Plenty to go over. All right. I want to get into the idea, the expectation of what the Federal Reserve will do and kind of put some things in perspective. You know, if you watch CNBC or you watch Bloomberg or any of these, you see guest after guest come on. They say, well, our base case now for rate cuts is one or two or something like that. And then remember, like 3 or 4 months ago, they were going on, they were saying, well, you know, our base case is 3 to 4 rate cuts. And I have to just remind people that, okay, well, first of all, when they're saying the implied Fed funds rate or the probability that the Fed will cut rates, they're looking at the price of the future. So there are, well, that sounds kind of funny. They're looking at futures prices, the futures market, where there's something called the Fed funds futures. They trade. And they have a price. And whatever the price is, you take 100 minus that, and that's the implied rate at that contract. So if you're looking at the September contract, the December contract, it has sort of this implied Fed funds rate in that price once you do a little bit of math on it. So the reason I want to start with this is, you know, this is a big thing. When will the Fed cut rates? I want to remind everybody, and not like you don't know this, you know, we just had a more than a 5% pullback. It seems like last 2 days, or at least today, or yeah, the last 2 days, markets have come back quite nicely after Google earnings report, Meta had the earnings report, and, you know, the market didn't really like the Meta report. Although when you look at it, it didn't seem too bad. Maybe it was the forward guidance or, you know, whatever. Tesla, you know, they had a report, I think, the street liked the report. I think investors liked it because, you know, more buyers than sellers. I can say that. Jay's not here. There were more buyers than sellers than Tesla. And the stock got bid up quite a bit. Google announces the first ever dividend. And I mean, that stock really gapped up. So, but let's get back to this. The market is up year to date. It's up about 7.3% total return, including dividends year to date. All right. So keep that in mind. Imagine at the end of last year, if you would have said, I know the market's expecting, you know, 3 or 4 rate cuts or even more. You know, if I go back just to, all right, here's the, I'm burying the headline. I think it's one cut now is what the Fed funds futures are implying. One cut. That's it. One cut this year. It's basically what it's implying. It was 2 for a while. Then, you know, we slipped below 3. I think it's 1 now. I think it's actually 1. So why do I bring this up? At the end of December, the end of last year, the implied Fed funds rate, now our effective Fed funds rate right now is 5.33%. The target rate set by the Fed is 5.25, 5.5. The implied rate in December, the end of December, was about 3.75. So, you know, you do the math, that's 150 basis points. That's 6 25 basis point cuts. 6 cuts. It's about 1 now. Market's up 7.3% year to date. This is why it's so difficult, even if you knew what was going to happen, for the expectations of the Fed funds rate based upon the future. And these change. We know they change. I just told you what they were at the end of December. They've changed since the beginning of the year. Beginning of the year, there was 100% probability at the May meeting, May 1st meeting next week, that they would cut rates. There's a 3% probability right now they'll cut rates. They're not cutting next week. And I will say that pretty much, you know, in past years, I think definitely during the Greenspan Fed, but in past years, it wasn't always a certainty that the futures market close to the meeting would sort of have it right. The Jay Powell Fed is not surprised. Basically, whatever was expected going into the meeting, they've done. And maybe they've done a really good job of telegraphing. We know they talk a lot. They go out and give speeches. They give interviews. This Fed talks than any other Fed that I remember. They talk a lot. But one cut now, and the market's still up. Imagine if you knew that if you said, oh, okay, we're not going to have six cuts in 24, and the expectation is going to go to one cut, you would have thought, oh, the market would be down. No. That's why we buy and hedge. That's why we buy and we buffer. You simply don't know. But let's get into it a little bit. Let me see who this was from. Is it Jim Bianco? Yes, Jim Bianco put something out. And he basically, this was his narrative. This is what he wrote. He said, you know, May 1st FOMC meeting, right now, really no chance of a cut. This is as of today, the Fed funds probability of a cut. 3% for next week. The June 12th meeting, only about 11.6% probability of a cut. Let's go to July 31st. All right, a little bit higher, 31.7%. And then you go September. The September meeting, about 57.60%. And June, I mean, early January, there was 100% probability that they would cut. 100%. No more. And, you know, one of the things that I think he said too, after this next week's meeting, the next FOMC meeting, okay, let me kind of read a little bit what he said, and I'm quoting here. The September 18th FOMC meeting has less than a 60% probability of them cutting. Since it's 5 months away, effectively it's a coin toss. After this, the next FOMC meeting, Federal Open Market Commission Federal Open Market Committee, yep, is Thursday, November 7th, 2 days after the election. And I'm still reading from what he wrote. In reality, the Fed is on hold until after the election, at the earliest, provided the data slows enough to warrant a cut, which it's currently not doing. So Jim Bianco has this, you know, saying basically, you know, it's a 50-50 coin toss that they'll have one rate cut before the election. So the reason I bring this up is I know right now you're watching stuff on TV and everything's around interest rates and everything's about the expectation of interest rates. And the market does change based upon those. In the end, buyers and sellers are the ones who set prices. Although Jay hates when I say, hey, there's more buyers than sellers. That's why the market went up. Why'd the market go down? More sellers than buyers. And sometimes that's just the reason. We're seeing in the bond market, the far end of the bond curve, something, you know, 30-year bonds, 10-year bonds, those yields have come up across the spectrum over the, you know, since the beginning of the year. But the market is still up about 7.3% year-to-date total return. So it's always funny. I mean, imagine, and we've said this before, I mean, imagine you knew inflation was going to be going through the roof. Like you would have bought TIPS bonds and you would have bought gold. Now, gold is, of course, making a new all-time high this week. But it's, you know, sometimes even if you know what's going to happen, you still don't know what the end product of the markets is going to be. But one cut, this is pretty significant, I think. Is it meaningful as far as what the market's going to do? I don't know. I think some of the pullback that we saw recently, and I mean, it's those happen all the time, although we haven't had a 5% pullback in a while. They kind of happen. And maybe a lot of this is investors or the markets sort of getting comfortable. Comfortable is not the right word, but getting used to the fact that, yeah, maybe we should have been listening to the Fed all along when they've been saying, I think Powell at one of the news conferences said, I'm not cutting. We're not cutting. And this higher for longer. I always go back to the 1990s. I did a whole episode just on the 90s and about interest rates and the 94-95 period and what happened with markets coming out of that. I'll put that link in the show notes so you can listen to that. So I won't get too into it here. But I still see that this period now reminds me of the 90s. And just because interest rates were high does not mean equities have to go down. I don't know what's going to happen. That's why we buy and we hedge. And I'm not telling you buy, I'm not telling you sell. If you want to buy the market, you buy it. If you want to sell it, you sell it. You do what you need to do. But I'm just telling you that we don't need rates at zero for the markets to go up. Part of the reason why we're hearing more talk about no cuts, the data doesn't support cutting, is inflation. And I'm almost as, you know, it's sort of, it's tiring talking about inflation at this point. But we're going to talk about it because it's interesting to me and it's interesting to the markets and people want to talk about it. They want to hear about it. So this week we had the PCE get released, and PCE is the preferred measure of inflation that the Federal Reserve watches. They've said it themselves. So although CPI gets all sort of the headlines and it's the star per se, it's PCE that the Powell and friends say they actually watch. And part of the reason is they weight things a little bit differently, and it's more broad. It also, I think I've said this before, I think it counts, you know, like insurance premiums that people are paying and different things like that. So Jay made fun of me when I brought up the super core. He's like, what the heck is the super core? So there's CPI, there's PCE, and then there's CPI core, PCE core, and then there's PCE and PCE super core. So one of the reasons why people started looking at super core is because it does not include shelter or housing. And the reason why they started looking at it is simply because they said, well, shelter is lagging. I know core PCE or core CPI, you know, especially is elevated because it has housing. You know, core is X food and energy. So super core is X food, energy, and housing. And they said, well, you know, it's lagging. And it was lagging on the way up, and it's probably lagging on the way down. Although I have seen some charts that show there's the disparity between what we'll call spot rents, meaning what new people are renting at, and what the rent levels are in CPI and that component. But you know, I don't want to take us off track. So core or super core PCE came out year over year. It's about 3.5%. So not a 2%, not a 2%. And I would say that over the last 1, 2, 3, about, you know, 4 months or so, 5 months, it's, you know, it's ticked up a little bit. I wouldn't say it's going up, but it's certainly not going down. And if you look in here, things like healthcare, I mean, it's basically services. Goods have been going lower. Durable goods have been going lower. But you look at healthcare, you look at different services within there, and they are higher. So, you know, I bring that up because that's one of the things that the Fed is looking at, and we know that inflation's not going away. And this is my opinion and my opinion only, but I think the Fed and Powell, they are afraid of lowering rates too soon and inflation going back up and having what happened to the Feds in, let's say, the late 70s, early 80s, where inflation kind of dipped and then came back. They don't want to do that. They'd rather be late to cut than early to cut and inflation going up. And the economy is doing well. I know people were disappointed with the GDP report, but it's still positive. Atlanta Fed GDP now for Q2, and it's way, way early for that indicator. It just looks at the data as it comes in. I think the first read was about positive 3.5. Of course, that's an annualized number. And, you know, so that's, but anyway, so there was also an interesting thing too, and every once in a while I get asked a question about, you know, can we really believe the inflation numbers? Just the other day, somebody asked me, she said, can we really believe these? Like, are they real? I thought actual inflation is higher. And of course, the stuff that you buy might be higher and relative to where it was a year, 2 years, 3 years ago. You go to the grocery store, I mean, some things are up a lot. I've said on air here, if you look at some hotels you've been to in the past, look at what it costs per night now. And I'm telling you, some of them have tripled. It's just an anecdotal thing that I sort of looked at. But people said, you know, I've heard the shadow inflation and all this stuff. All right, so here's an interesting point I found. I think it was Larry Summers. Larry Summers or a couple other authors, co-authors, they wrote a paper. And prior to 1983, they used to use, they did things a little bit different with regard to how they measured specifically the housing component or the shelter component of inflation. And part of what they did was they would include things like mortgage interest payments. So as interest rates went higher, so if the Fed, let's say, was going to combat inflation by raising interest rates, when interest rates got raised, it would sort of raise the housing component of CPI because it included mortgage interest payments. So they sort of, you know, that was one of the things. They also were theoretically double counting, where they'd include somebody's home purchase price and the mortgage payments as well. And in reality, like, you buy the mortgage unless you're paying cash. But essentially, I mean, yes, you buy the house, but really your cost as a consumer is your mortgage payment every month, again, unless you pay cash. And, you know, I think it only used 30-year mortgages, even if there were, you know, a 10-year ARM that was less. And, you know, we know people a lot of times, especially, you know, went to adjustable rate mortgages and things like that. So the problem, you know, that they identified was they said, well, and we have these people too that are in houses that may not need to move at all. So they switched over to something called owner's equivalent rent. And I could do a show for 3 hours on owner's equivalent rent. I won't, because I want to keep the listeners. But essentially that basically, it's theoretically what your home could rent for, given, you know, the other houses in your neighborhood and what rents are going in and things like that. All right. So it's a little bit different. And they said, well, you know, there's probably a better way to do this. All right. So you can probably look up pre-1983 inflation components of housing. And the other thing that I would tell you is, so anyway, getting back to this Larry Summers piece, I think it was Larry Summers, a couple other people. And it gets to the question somebody asked me, and I said, I'm happy to talk about it on the podcast. It seems like CPI should be higher. All right. Well, what they normally referring to is, if you estimated CPI using pre-1983 housing and including personal interest payments, what would inflation be? And this is kind of what you see. I think it's Shadow Stats that puts this out. But, you know, the methodology changed. We know that inflation peaked out. We never hit 10% year over year. But I think it was, what was it, above 9, I believe, or right around there. But if you use the pre-1983 housing methods in the CPI calculation, I think we would have had 18% CPI. And believe it or not, that would have been higher than what we saw in the late 70s. I think in the late 70s, it peaked out close to 15%. I don't have the exact year. And so to answer, you know, that question, and maybe your question, I know a lot of people have been thinking about this. Yeah, if you measured inflation the same way, our inflation based upon this paper that I'm looking at would have been higher than it was in the 70s. So yeah, but is it a good way of measuring inflation? I don't know. I think that they have a point, because if you have a house and you are not, you know, you're locked into a mortgage and you've already bought your house, it doesn't matter what home prices do, and it doesn't matter what interest rates do, because you're set. You've got your house, you've got your payment. So anyway, that's a quick way of doing that. But I thought it was an interesting point. And it brings up the issue of, you know, when you look at, and I think this is why, I forget who posted this, but one of the things they were looking at is how people feel. And although, you know, inflation is down, we know that inflation really never goes down. The rate of change goes down. The rate of change goes down off a higher base. So if everything's 20% higher than it was 2 years ago or 3 years ago, and now it's great, it's only, you know, 3.8% year over year. Well, it's 3.8% off after the 20%. So it's on a higher base. So it's all cumulative. It all sort of snowballs. But yeah, I mean, if you look at the interest payments, if you are buying a house right now versus buying a house a couple of years ago, you're paying a lot more. Even if home prices, I mean, we know home prices are up, but in the end, it's really the interest rate that matters. So I thought I had this question and I said, how do I do this in a quick way? I hope I did a good job of explaining that. But basically they used to use a different way of computing CPI prior to 83. There were some changes in the 90s as well. And they used to include, like, personal interest payments, mortgage interest. They used to include, you know, I think they used to include taxes in that too. I'm not sure they do anymore. So, all right, let's bring it back to the markets though. And I always say, and Jay and I always joke about, you know, do we want to scare people this week? Do we want to make people feel good? I mean, it would be so much easier if we just scared people. We'd probably have more listeners. But I will tell you that for all the talk of interest rates and all the talk about the Fed and the economy, if you look at corporate earnings and corporate earnings analyst estimates, they're still really good. And I say really good. Again, I don't know what's going to happen with the market. But if you look at the forward 12-month earnings estimates, the growth there based upon the analyst is over 9%. If you look at the, you know, month 13 through month 24, so, you know, fiscal, like 2 years out, right? The next year is about 9%. 2 years out, that year is about 12.8% growth. And then you look, like 3 years out, and the, you know, these are analyst expectations, about plus 7.8%. These are the estimates. Can the estimate change? Of course they can. They do all the time. They've changed in the last 6 months. They've changed to the upside. Earnings estimates and analysts have higher estimates of future growth and earnings. The other thing that we're seeing too is that, you know, if I look at sales, so there's different metrics you can look at, sales per share, earnings per share, those types of things. And by the way, just to throw some numbers on it, so the forward estimate is $243.49. That's a per share estimate for the S&P. Think about the S&P index as a whole, all these companies smushed together, and on a per share basis, $243.49. So then you say, well, what's the forward multiple? What's the forward price to earnings ratio? All right, well, if you take, what'd we close today? Around 50-90, right around there. I'll use that because it's easy math. Take the 50-90 divided by the 243.49, and the forward PE would be about 20.9. All right? That's a forward estimate. So, you know, it's, and this can change too. If the market comes down and the earnings estimates for the next four quarters stay the same, the forward PE will drop. If the market stays where it is and the earnings estimates rise, the forward PE can drop. And the market can go up and the PE can drop as well if the earnings estimates go up at a higher rate of change. That's actually what we've seen with NVIDIA, where earnings have grown and earnings estimates have grown. The price has gone way up, but the forward PE ratio went down. So I bring this up and I always say, you know, you bring it back to earnings. In the long run, corporate earnings matter. And the other thing I'll tell you is that me and Mike talked about it last week on the episode. You should go back and listen to that one. The share of earnings based upon the Magnificent Seven, and we kind of looked at the Magnificent Seven versus the S&P. And people are very critical of the idea that you have these seven companies or however many companies make up a pretty good weight of the S&P 500 index. And, if you go back, by the way, look at 1980. You would have seen Exxon have a pretty big share of the S&P. I think it was Exxon. You would see different types of companies. But when you look at this and they say, well, you know, it's only, remember though, the S&P 500, I just gave you the per share estimate. All of those earnings come into one big pot, the S&P 500. And all the earnings come in and all the sales come in, everything's come in and it's all sort of smushed together. And believe it or not, I mean, the point of bringing that up is just simply, like, you can have different companies provide earnings. So, well, I will agree though that, you know, your Microsofts, your Apples, your NVIDIAs, the big companies, those, I mean, their raw revenues are higher than member 500 in the S&P. So, yeah, I mean, they do matter, but the earnings can come from anywhere. I think it was Professor Jeremy Siegel in his books, Stocks for the Long Run. By the way, if you haven't read that before, there's a new edition. I think it came out, probably 6, 7, maybe even a year ago. I forget. But it's worth reading. And he goes through sort of the long run about returns. And he goes back quite far. He's got a really interesting chart in there. It's the growth of a dollar if you invested in stocks in like the late 1800s and reinvested dividends and versus gold versus housing versus a dollar. I always liked that chart. But one of the things he made the point, I think he wrote an article in the Wall Street Journal in 2009. You know, the earnings were pretty skewed because you had big companies and a lot of them were writing down, you know, they were just writing down everything and taking losses in the quarter. And it was just interesting because he said, you know, maybe you should weight the earnings. I don't necessarily agree with him because I think it's the S&P and you just throw them in a pot and they're all together. But he made the argument that if you would have weighted the earnings decline wouldn't have been as great on a weighted basis. If I find that, I'll put it in the show notes. I'd have to find that though. So bringing it back to earnings, I mean, this is always the thing that I like to watch because in the end, it's earnings matter. Earnings really, really matter. All right. And speaking of earnings, next week, I think May 2nd, next week's kind of a big week. We got the Fed decision May 1st, and nobody thinks they're going to cut or raise or anything like that. What's interesting is always the press conference. So Chairman Powell got asked 87 different ways. When are you going to cut? What do you need to see to cut? Are you cutting at this meeting? What are the chances you could? I mean, they'll just ask him the same question 18 different ways. I wish I could be at that press conference and actually ask him real questions rather than the same question 50 different ways. But they haven't asked yet. And then Apple May 2nd earnings. That will be a big earnings report. And Apple always sort of, you know, it a lot of times will drive the market. It's interesting to see what they say in their report. Earnings are great because not that Apple's earnings is going to be great, but earnings season's great because it's the chance you get a look at the company. And a lot of times they give some forward messaging and guidance that's new information. But then to me, NVIDIA's, and they're not till May 22nd, but NVIDIA's the one that I think, I mean, that's the most interesting to me. And NVIDIA really from, you know, the end of last year and especially this year, they've been driving everything. And by driving everything, I mean that they've had a disproportionate share from the gains of the S&P 500. I mean, they've driven a lot of the gains. And they last couple of earnings estimates or reports, they've beat by a lot. They've changed their forward guidance, upped it by a lot. But what is the options market saying about NVIDIA? The options market gives information because if you're going to buy an option from someone, let's say you just buy an option, you're going to have a market maker on the other side. And they have to figure out, what do you price it at? Well, part of that pricing goes into how they hedge. So if you buy a call option and I'm the market maker in theory, I don't put a market maker hat on. I am not, but I will put the hat on for a second. If you buy a call option from me on NVIDIA, and let's say you buy an at-the-money call option, it's got a 50 delta, meaning that option's price at a 50 delta for every 1-point move in NVIDIA, that will move 50%. So if you own a call option at the money and it's 50 delta, NVIDIA goes up by a dollar, you would expect all else equal, and it never is, you know, as far as interest rates and volatility and all that other stuff, but let's just isolate the one component, you would expect to go up about, you know, 50 cents. So if I'm the market maker, I have to go and buy 50 shares of NVIDIA to hedge because I really don't want to have a position. So you buy your call option, it's 50 delta. I'm going to buy 50 shares of NVIDIA to hedge. And then as that goes further in the money or goes out of the money, the deltas change and I can reduce or I have to increase my hedge. So I look at the options market and we know that NVIDIA is scheduled to report, not certain, but scheduled to report on 5/22. There is an earnings or an options expiration on May 24th. So I thought I would take a look at those options. And NVIDIA closed right around 877.35. And I wanted to take a look and see what, you know, there's not really a pure at the money, but I went and looked at the 875 strike price. So these are on the call side a little bit in the money by $2.35. They're out of the money by $2.35 on the put side. But what if you looked at the 875 strike? And what I found was the implied volatility there was roughly 64%. And so what does that mean? Well, that's an annualized number. And basically, they're taking, this is an expiration, that's May 24th. And on an annualized basis, they're saying, you know, a one standard deviation move annualized would be about 64%. All right, so we bring that back and we say, well, what's the option market really expecting from on a one-day move? Well, the way you do that is you take the implied volatility divided by the square root of time, which the square root of time is the number of trading days in the year, which is, I think it's 252 this year. We've got, I think we got a number of we want one more holiday this year than we had last year. Because I think we, there was a holiday that, anyway, it doesn't matter. So, and that's 15.875, the square root of 252. 64 divided by 15.875. And you wind up with, you know, roughly about a 4% expected one day move. That's kind of the one standard deviation one day. Okay. So the options market is, I mean, that it's pricing in 4% is sort of like, yeah, I mean, it's a one standard deviation expected move. And today, I mean, did NVIDIA move more than 4% today? Yeah, it did. It did actually. If you look at NVIDIA and today, let's see, it moved, it was up 6.18%. So it actually moved, well, I'll get to that. We didn't, but it moved more than the expected move based upon the pricing and the implied volatility in the options market. So what does this mean for earnings? Okay. Well, let's say that an investor wanted to, and I'm not saying you should do this. If you like NVIDIA, buy it. If you don't like it, don't buy it. I don't know what's going to happen with NVIDIA's price. But you said, okay, let's take a look and say, I think NVIDIA is going to move and I'm going to use the options that expire 2 days after the expected earnings date. Well, you look at the at-the-money straddle. At-the-money straddle means you buy the call and you buy the put because you think there's going to be a big move. Okay. That is expensive though. And whether it's expensive depends on how much the stock goes up or down. So one day is 4%. If I want to figure out what the implied one standard deviation move is out to the May 24th expiration, what I've actually got, it's about 28 calendar days. So one way to do it is I can take my 4% times the square root of 28. I'm throwing a lot of math at you. And basically it's about 21% is the 20 day over the next 28 days, 21%. One standard deviation implied move by the options prices. So basically what I'm telling you is that the options market is pricing a certain amount of volatility or expected volatility. Will it move that much? Who knows? If it moves more than that, well, prices should have been higher. If it moves less, well, maybe prices should have been lower. I guess it depends on the perspective, whether you're a buyer or seller. The other way to look at this is like, how much would the at the money or around the money straddle cost? Now, if you bought the 875 call and put, it would cost you about $125.50. And that means your break even on NVIDIA, the underlying, would be $1,285. You'd either make or lose money in theory if it went there. And $751.85 is your break even. And if it doesn't move that much, you lose money because it didn't move enough because you're paying for both sides. So typically, and to give you an idea too, I looked at Apple's implied volatility for the ones, now it's next week, but they've only got about a 32% implied volatility. Does that mean that's a better buy than NVIDIA? Absolutely not. I'm not saying that. I'm just saying the options market, based upon where the prices are, they are pricing in a certain amount of move embedded in the value of the options. And that's why a lot of times first time or new option traders say, well, everybody knows the stock's going to move at earnings. Yeah, probably, maybe not. They don't always move, but the option market knows that and it prices it in. And so that's kind of what you're looking at today with NVIDIA. And just, I bring this one up because I think it's, I mean, to me, it's an important earnings report because last couple times when it came out, it really helped the market because it beat on its estimates and also raise guidance. No idea what if they're going to beat this time or if they're going to raise guidance or lower guidance. We'll see when we see. I should mention, by the way, that that was actually a question from a listener too. So actually, let me read the question. We're happy to get questions. Derek.Moore@ZegaFinancial.com. That's Derek.Moore@ZegaFinancial.com. Z as in zebra, E as in Eddie, G as in George, A as in Apple, financials up to you to spell correctly.com. And listener, actually, I guess I should have read this beforehand, but he said, really love the podcast. I feel like I'm learning a lot. Good. Glad to hear that. Enjoy you and Jay's banter back and forth. I enjoy that too. And their question was, how does the option market anticipate earnings announcements? And it's kind of embedded in the, it's included in the price of the option. what the options market thinks as far as expected volatility. It's in there. Without getting too technical and bullish or bearish, that's kind of what we go with. All right. So do send emails and we'll try and, we would start reading more of the listener questions on air. I've got a couple queued up for next week as well. When Jay is back, I think we're going to talk about time decay. I had a few questions on time decay and really explaining that a little bit more, how that works with options. And I would say, you know, for everyone out there, try to not get caught up in the day-to-day news. Like if you're just sitting there watching financial news and they're giving all these opinions, imagine trying to trade off all that, or somebody says something one day, or, and I just showed you, imagine you knew that by this time, the Fed funds futures would only be implying essentially one rate cut and a coin flip that we'd have a rate cut before the election, but the market's up. You know, you just don't know. And I guess I've been watching a lot of the hockey playoffs. I'm a big hockey fan. And really, that's my recommendation for this week, is to watch hockey, especially if you haven't. It's a great sport and it's in the playoffs. And there's nothing like playoff hockey. There's a lot more hitting and a lot of the games go into overtime. Overtime keeps going. Doesn't matter if it has to go to 3 a.m, they keep going. I really haven't been reading or watching anything else this week. So that's my recommendation. But imagine if you were watching, whether it's hockey or football or anything. I mean, the NFL draft was last night. I'm recording this on a Friday. And it's like they skip all those announcers, you know, they're a round table. There's five or six people at a table with microphones. And I don't know, will they draft this person? Will they draft this person? Really? You know, like imagine trying to, none of that matters when what actually happens. It's the same thing with pregame shows in football. Like they summarize, they speculate, they make their picks. They're like, oh, I think this is going to happen. This is going to happen. And then none of it happens. Stuff just happens. And I think the things that you're looking at today in 6 months, if the expectations that they'll raise a quarter point interest rate, would that surprise me? No, it wouldn't surprise me. It wouldn't surprise me if they cut a couple times too. But I think the point is that in 6 months, the expectations will be different based upon the new information. And the market has a digestive phase where it sort of takes in all this information. But in the end, it's earnings. I will tell you one other thing, and I found an interesting point, and that is dealing with elections. So we're coming up and, Shay, should we sell in May and go away? Well, May to October, the S&P performance, this is from Ryan Dietrich and FactSet, I think is who put this out. And they did it based upon the first year of a president's term, the midterm year, pre-election year, which was last year, and then election year, which is this year. Yes, we have an election this year. Can't wait for all the commercials. No, I can't stand the commercials. So the S&P performance May through April was broken down. In the first year, 66.7% of the time. Well, let me just cut to the chase. In an election year, 77.8% of the time, this is 1950 to current, markets were higher from May to October. So you remember this whole thing? Everybody knows, sell in May and go away. All right, well, sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And the worst year is actually 52.6% of the time, markets are up in a midterm year. So that's sort of the lowest historically when markets are up. And the performance from May to October in a midterm year, which was 2022, so that's in the past, on average, 0.1%. But average, 2.3% higher between average performance May through October. So I don't know. I bring this up. We are in election year. And historically, the markets seem to like election years. And usually, if you're going to have trouble, you have trouble in a midterm year. But what is it, a year after the midterms since 1950, the markets haven't been lower? I don't know. We'll worry about the midterm in 2026. But anyway, a little pre-election stuff. That's it. I'm done. Watch hockey. Jay will be back next week. See everyone. Bye.